The Health and Human Services Budget Division is called to order. Obviously, some of our members don't think we're meeting on Mondays yet. We got two of us now. So we can begin. We were going to continue with the presentations that we did not finish last week, and we're going to start with the area of chemical and mental health with Assistant Commissioner Wes Koistra.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Wes Koistra, and you had asked last hearing whether we could complete in about a half hour. I think we can do that. We were on the Governor's Mental Health Initiative page, which begins on page 183 of your budget book. I will continue on at page 187. Just to mention, so far we've covered adopting the standard mental health benefit set across public programs. We've also covered the addition of a intensive outpatient treatment benefit and the development of integrated care networks. Also the increase in rates, as well as continued funding for the web-based tracking system for starting with acute care hospitalization and then moving to other services, as well as the web-based outcomes measurement piece. And so that brings us to the top of page 187, which is improved county financial incentives for ensuring community-based service access for the uninsured. This proposal was part of our package last year. It has changed somewhat. Just as background, the counties currently contribute 20% of the cost of regional treatment center placement when it's not covered by other insurance. Last year we proposed the 20% be increased to 50% after 60 days. We did that because by and large, not everybody, but by and large, people are stabilized usually within 30 days and almost all within 60 days and are ready for community placement. As an example of that, in the Anoka Regional Treatment Center, we typically have an admissions waiting list of about 40, and we typically have a discharge waiting list of about 70. So that tells you that we have people in the Anoka Regional Treatment Center that are waiting for discharge, but because of lack of community services or lack of development of community services, they're being required to stay there longer than necessary. This year, rather than maintaining the 20% county share in the first 60 days and moving to 50% after that, the change that we are making here is that we are forgiving the county share during the first 30 days, retaining the county share from days 30 to 60, and then again increasing to 50 after that. So the major change is forgiving a county share during the first 30 days off of last year's proposal. We're doing this to recognize that this is a change. It's based upon trying to drive incentives for the right service at the right place. It's not trying to penalize counties. It's really essentially trying to provide the incentives that make it so that institutional care is not the least costly alternative to community-based care. Later, the remaining elements of the proposal, we'll talk about a lot of the investments that we're putting into the community-based side to give counties tools for development of more community-based services that we think would help them avoid the longer lengths of stay in the regional treatment centers that this piece is trying to avoid. I'll also mention that this applies to the regional treatment centers, and really by the time this summer's over, the only regional treatment center remaining will be the Anoka Regional Treatment Center. The other catchment areas of the state are served by community-based behavioral hospitals, and this does not apply to that. And I would also add that we do not have the lengths of stay in our experience so far in those hospitals. Those hospitals have an average length of stay of somewhere between 20 and 25, which we think is probably about right given the acute care needs of people with mental illness. So the idea is not to avoid hospitalization when it's needed. The idea is not to have people be discharged from hospitals before they're ready, but really to provide incentives for timely discharge. Madam Chair, the next set of elements are a set of investment strategies that really try to address some of the needs of the uninsured and underinsured. As we've discussed here in the past, The state and the counties have a unique role in the safety net for people with mental illness. Unlike other healthcare diseases, it is typically the state and county who have to serve the cost of untreated or poorly treated people with mental illness. We do that within local grants for uninsured and underinsured to maintain community placements. We also do that through regional treatment center placements where the counties pay 20%, and we typically, as a state, pay 80% unless it's insured. So these investments are intended to provide counties with more tools to address needs earlier of people with mental illness, and it's particularly points to those who are underinsured and uninsured. The first element is to develop statewide mental health crisis intervention and stabilization infrastructure. I'll mention that last year we received short-term funding for this of a total of $1 million for children and adults, $750,000 for adults, $250,000 for children. This adds funding of $3 million in the beginning, going to $9 million, and this, again, is intended to develop crisis and stabilization services statewide. It should be noted that 30% of the crisis services are now uncompensated and that crisis providers cannot deny services to people that need them, whether or not they are covered either by a public program or by a private insurance program. So we think this is an important element that will address some of the backlog in the emergency rooms and in the psychiatric beds and the psychiatric bed demand that we're seeing today, especially in the metro area. The next element is to shore up children's school and community-based mental health services. I'll mention again that both the previous item I spoke
for
to.
For those of you that have just come in, we're on page 188 of the budget book. Continue. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, the next item is to shore up children's school and community-based mental health services. The context that's important to note for this is that we have been funding a lot of children's mental health services through what we call children's mental health collaboratives and family service collaboratives. Due to changes in federal policy, we've lost significant amounts of federal revenue. I believe the estimate is about $40 million a year in federal revenue that was supporting these services. These services provided a wide range of service from very targeted clinical services to softer services. What we're trying to do here is at least retain the services that were the most critical in nature and the most critical clinical care, the most critical care coordination activities, and prevention activities. What we're proposing here would amount to about a little over $13 million a year. This is an increase over last year's proposal, and it represents about a third of the funds that we've lost to federal policy changes for these collaboratives. The next element is to develop and support evidence-based practices and best practices. Included in this, the primary area of investment here is the assertive community treatment teams, which I spoke to earlier, that our intensive treatment teams, community-based treatment teams that help avoid hospitalization. In fact, sometimes they're referred to as hospitals without walls. We probably have enough demand for ACT teams to consume the funding being requested here. I think somebody told me that we probably could use 10 more of these teams in the metro area. So we want to first support the demand for the assertive community treatment teams, but we also want to build on some of the work that we're doing in other evidence-based practice, including supporting integrated dual diagnosis treatment for people who have co-occurring mental illness and chemical dependency. I believe I mentioned this committee before that 60% of people with serious and persistent mental illness also have a co-occurring chemical dependency. We do have a federal grant, by the way, for integrated dual diagnosis of about $3.5 million over, I believe, 5 years. I'm not absolutely certain of the time frame. But that grant is fairly targeted towards a specific population and specific sites. And so we would hope to use some of these funds to augment that grant so we can get some of this care to adolescents, so we can get some of this care to adults that are not in sites that are covered by the federal grant. We also want to use some funding to expand the Hawaii-based model database project. Again, I've mentioned that project is the development of a web-based data web-based system where clinicians can access data on treatment approaches that have worked based upon a client's age, a client's race, a client's diagnosis. You put certain demographics into this system, a clinician can enter that information, and they will get a list of treatment approaches that have been attempted with those individuals and be able to determine which ones have worked best given the individual demographics of that child. It's not intended to replace clinical decision-making, but it's intended to be a clinical decision-making tool. We also want to develop more co-location and medical home models. We have been doing some work with that, especially in the children's area. CentraCare in the St. Cloud area is a care system that we've been working closely with and been having very good results in the development of co-location models. We've also worked with children's hospital and clinics in the metro area, and we want to expand that work, and we also want to expand medical home models for people with mental illness. When you look at medical home models for people with mental illness, it may be a little different than the general population. A medical home for a person with mental illness could be the mental health practitioner rather than the primary care practitioner. But we want to work so that both models can work for this population. The next element is to develop and support treatment resources for groups with specialized treatment needs. Included in this would be grants that would address needs for critical culturally competent mental health services. We have certainly in this state a significant immigrant population. We know we don't do well with the African-American population, the Latino population, or the American Indian population. And so we want to develop some services that respond to the specific cultural needs of these clients. And so some of this funds will be used for that. We also need to develop niche services. There are certain situations where we send our patients out of state because we don't have the services capacity in this state. Eating disorders is an example. Treatment-resistant psychoses. And because of the lack of an infrastructure, we end up paying costly care out of state. It's difficult to have care systems develop these services because in their care system, their client demand is not enough to warrant their development. But so we're thinking that from a state perspective, we need to develop these things within the state because we end up paying for them regardless. The final investment piece is expanding access to a range of housing options. I'll mention that the MHFA budget includes some additional funding for Bridges money, which is rental subsidy until Section 8 subsidies come into effect for individuals. Assistant Commissioner Johnson talked about housing funding in his proposal. That's targeted to the long-term homeless, which has a very particular definition behind it. This is housing options that go beyond what the long-term homeless proposal do and are more flexible than what the Bridges funding provides. And we would base the housing options on the needs that become part of the response to a request for a proposal. And we know that housing needs are different based upon locality. Hennepin County's needs may be different than Ramsey County's needs or the surrounding suburbs, and certainly all those are different than greater Minnesota. So we want this to be a flexible approach to providing services in housing environments that go beyond long-term homelessness. Madam Chair, that's the completion of that page. Then I have one other page on page 228 of your book.
Why don't we just stop here and see if there are any questions on this part of it. Yes, Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Osberg.
No, this is Wes Koistra.
Well, thank you very much. I apologize, Mr. Koistra. This is a very good overview that you gave us, and I'm always so troubled when I hear about the need out there for mental health services and how we don't have enough resources or there aren't the program supports and personnel supports out there that this population of people needs, especially when we're talking about children. Now, you mentioned earlier there was a $40 million cut to these children's programs. Is that what you said?
Madam Chair, Senator Ropes, that's correct. The federal government changed their approach to to a policy with respect to what could be billed to the Family Children's Services Collaboratives. I can have staff give you the technical changes that occurred, but it really essentially the bottom line is it resulted in $40 million a year.
Madam Chair.
Those were federal cuts.
Yes.
Right. And I'm sure that you guys are in contact with, our federal peers and decision makers out there. Can you give us a clue as to why they would come up with policy changes that would result in $40 million cuts at children's programs?
Madam Chair, Senator, I've said to other people if I could read the federal mind, I'd probably be in a much more lucrative job than I am today. But there's been a pattern of policy changes, and I would say that we are also facing some changes in targeted case management that I think have been referenced in previous pages that have really hurt state governments in terms of funding, especially in human services. And while some of them have been a result of the changes that were passed in law changes, there also have been there's been a lot of administrative activity with respect to changing policy through changing interpretation of law, changing rules, et cetera. And so I don't know what's driving it. I guess you probably have as many guesses as I do, but it's a difficult situation for us.
The new budget doesn't look like it's getting better either. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One other question. You mentioned the assertive community treatment teams, the ACT teams, and it designates a 7-county metro area, and you mentioned that there's actually need for another 10 teams. Do they go out into the rural areas at all? Are rural areas covered with these Hospitals Without Borders?
Yeah. Madam Chair, the reason this particular area, we've talked mostly about the metro area, is we do have ACT teams in greater Minnesota as well. And I will say that we're doing not perfectly in greater Minnesota, but the information we're getting in terms of community supports suggests to us that our greatest area of need is in the metro area. You can see that with the performance of our behavioral health hospitals. When people seem to be admitted to the hospital, get the care they need until stabilization, there seems to be a place for them to go. There's also been less admissions there. And I will say greater Minnesota has done just a wonderful job of building a community-based infrastructure there, and they've done it through collaborative planning across counties. There's the part of the adult mental health initiatives. So there is a service in greater Minnesota. We think that the demand is mostly in the metro area right now. And that's where we're seeing, frankly, the psychiatric bed crisis, which, by the way, affects metro area, because then they start seeking psychiatric, metro area clients start seeking psychiatric beds in outstate Minnesota. And that's where we're seeing unnecessary stays as well. And again, I want to differentiate needed stay from a necessary stay, because there are both.
Senator, the beginning of the ACT team funding in Minnesota was a part of the regional treatment center closures in rural Minnesota. So that's where they started first. And because, we were seeing declining hospitalizations in rural Minnesota through our regional treatment centers, we were able to do that restructuring of the financing. Anoka, you can't just close Anoka because it's so big. And so I think the hope is that with more ACT teams in the metro area, that we will see a slower enrollment at the Anoka Regional Treatment Center over time, and then perhaps down the road a ways some restructuring there also.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could also remind the committee that we handed out some maps, and those maps show where many of these services are delivered by area of the state. So
right.
I don't know that they're with you today, but
you
I just
saved it. It was a purple folder.
It answers some of the questions about how the services are dispersed.
Other questions about this proposal? Okay, just for the record, I just want it to be known that quite a number of these initiatives are funded in the governor's request through the Healthcare Access Fund. And so that is a problem. And I personally support the proposal, but we will be working very hard to try to find the appropriate funding sources for the proposal.
Madam Chair, our next page is page 228. This is a reduction in appropriation for the Minnesota Security Hospital. These services are located in our St. Peter campus, and this reduction is based entirely on projections of patients for that proposal for that facility. As background, prior to the Rodriguez case, we were seeing a growth of this program of about 5 people per year. After that case and the changes in policy, which really affected the sex offender population, which I want to stress is a much different population than people who are committed as mentally ill and dangerous, which this program serves. But we also appeared that there was an effect on the number of commitments for this population as well. I think it was an issue where people were concerned about public safety, and we saw a growth that was running at about 25 per year. So we requested funds last year to cover that growth. It was a significant request. And this year, as we're doing our projection, it appears that growth has tapered off to about 19 per year. Madam Chair, I will also mention that we're going to be forecasting growth in both the sex offender program and the security hospital even though they are not forecasted programs, we're going to do this in the same time frames of the other forecasts. And so far, we're seeing indications that that growth may go down a little bit more. But that'll be finalized as part of the February change pages. So the trend that we're seeing is hopeful in the sense that it's getting back to the kind of growth we were seeing before. It won't get all the way to the 5, but it's improving.
I think if I can just say one of the concerns that I have, not in regard to the security hospital, but the sex offender program, is the use by the counties of committing juveniles there. The lack of criteria, really, that is used. Some of these juveniles have never been adjudicated as having ever even committed a crime. And I think you just get them. I understand that. But I think those of us on this side of the table need to be a little bit concerned about how you get them. And so hopefully at some point we'll be able to have some discussion about that. I realize it doesn't relate to this page, but... Are there any questions on this page? Yes,
Madam
Senator.
Chair. Would you, Commissioner, would you clarify again? The reductions here are because the proposed plan to add beds to deal with sex offenders is what is diminishing. But did I understand that the expectation is that this security hospital continue to serve the mentally ill and dangerous?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, what this page reflects, we serve 2 populations currently at St. Peter, the sex offender program, which serves people committed to sex offenders, and then the security hospital, which are people committed as MI, mentally ill and dangerous. And what this page reflects is less growth than what our funding current level of funding was anticipated. We were expecting a growth of 25 patients per year, and we have base funds to support that. Now we're seeing that the growth is tapering off to about 19 a year, again, keeping in mind that at one time it was 5 a year before the Rodriguez case. So it's not a reduction in services from what is currently there. It's a reduction in the growth that we're anticipating because we already have the funds appropriated to anticipate the growth.
And I might just add, this is a very expensive service. So while it sounds like, you know, going from 25 to 19 shouldn't be that big a deal, because the cost per day of this service is so high, it does have quite a budget impact. Does Senator Sharon.
I understood those, the change and the basis for the change, that you anticipated more growth than in fact is happening, and so the adjustment is substantial, $2.98 million. But I'm just trying to understand, is the intent and is the growth that you're trying to measure or anticipate here is because of the shifts of the sex offender program away from the security hospital?
Madam Chair, I think I understand the question. The fact that we are going to be eventually moving the sex offender program to the Moose Lake campus, that activity has already been assumed in the budget, and that doesn't, there's nothing on this page that applies to that. Am I getting at your question?
Yes, okay. Yes.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Now we'll resume with the presentation that was being made by the Healthcare Division, Assistant Commissioner Brian Osberg.
Excuse me. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Osberg, Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare for the Department of Human Services. Our budget pages begin on page 126. This proposal would increase the medical mileage reimbursement for Minnesota Healthcare Program clients who drive themselves to a medical service, but also for neighbors and friends and relatives who help them get to a medical service. We cover through our medical assistance program transportation to get either prescription drugs or medical services in general. Now, what we would do here is set the reimbursement at 15 cents below the IRS business rate. Currently, the rate is 20 cents per mile. Which is in statute since 1995. This would bring it up to 33.5 cents per mile. Obviously, with the rising cost of gas, it's important that we bring this up, because otherwise people would rather than use a more expensive form of transportation like a taxi cab if it's not affordable for them to drive. So what we want to do is set it to 15 cents below the current IRS business rate of 48.5 cents. And linking this now going forward to that IRS business rate would then bring this rate up, this 33.5 cents up automatically. It will not have to come back and revisit this in statute every 2 years. This will be financed out of the general fund at $1.4 million for the next biennium.
Any questions on this page? Move on then.
The next item is on page 132. This proposal would continue the provider pay for performance program for clients in state healthcare programs who have diabetes and extend it to rewarding providers for achieving optimal care for our clients with cardiac disease. Obviously, these diseases are very serious, and they have a substantial impact on the health of our clients as well as the cost of our program. We believe that rewarding optimal care for these two chronic diseases can help prevent future healthcare complications for our clients and reduce our healthcare costs. This initiative covers both fee-for-service clients and managed care clients. Remember now, 70% of our clients are enrolled in managed care and 30% in our fee-for-service arrangement. Keep that in mind. There's two methods that we're using here in terms of rewarding providers for our clients achieving optimal care. One is that we're working with the employer community, the Buyers Healthcare Action Group, in developing something called Bridges to Excellence, whereby we provide rewards to medical groups who, for their caseload of diabetics, they achieve a certain target for optimal care. The next this upcoming year for 07, the target is 20%. Actual achievement the last few years has been 6%. So we're getting there, improving. And I don't know what the most recent number is, but it's better than 6%. But for our clients, it's not even that. It was 5% optimal care. And optimal care for diabetics is measured really by, again, outcome, not so much just what's done, but what is the outcome. And there's a number of indicators, including your A1C level, blood pressure, cholesterol level, and whether or not a person smokes. Those are the things that we measure in terms of whether or not they're good outcomes for our clients. And we're doing this across the board, not only in our private programs, but also, I mean, in our public programs, but also working with the private community on this. So one method we have is to join forces with the other purchasers and to reward clinics who will achieve more than 20% results this upcoming year. The second method of reimbursing for this program is for our fee-for-service side. We pay a provider directly for every one of our clients who achieve this optimal care. And so we will pay them a direct amount. So we're going to do both of these, in part because we have to do that because of federal requirements. Federal law says that we have to only pay for a fee-for-service, we can only pay for a service that's directly provided to a client. So we cannot aggregate some of our monies like we're doing the other method. So those are the two approaches we're taking with rewarding providers. This is done in the context of something called QCARE. Last year, the governor announced the QCARE initiative, whereby we're trying to identify things that work, measure those things, and reward those things. The governor and others have been in the private sector have been developing this over a period of time, recognizing established clinical guidelines and using consistent measures. And the QCARE initiative has really been in four areas: diabetes, hospital admissions, preventive care, and cardiac care. Now, we hope to also expand this to include depression and asthma over time. Again, we believe that we need to continue to expand our ability to reward providers for good results. And one thing that we're working on is trying to figure out how best to do that for hospitals as well. We're tracking carefully Medicare's projects in rewarding results in the hospital side. So we hope to maybe this next year have a proposal for the legislature that would do the same thing in the hospital side. But this is for ambulatory care results for ambulatory providers who right now it's diabetes, next it's going to be cardiac services, and then depression and asthma that follow.
Assistant Commissioner, regarding this page, there are savings that are not shown in the budget book. But over the next two bienniums, the savings do not offset the cost of the proposal.
Madam Chair, that's correct. The savings are there. They do offset the cost at this point, but they don't offset entirely the cost. At some point, we will see that happen. We don't see that happen the next two biennium, but I believe that at some point we will see that result. Once we get to the point in which we're actually directing more of our clients to these better-performing providers, that's what it's going to take for us to get these kind of results or more savings, is just make sure that these providers who are doing a good job get even more of our clients. That kind of ability to direct or promote or to steer, if you will, people to those better performing providers is going to be, I think, the key to getting at some point net savings in this program. And I think that's going to happen within the next 5 to 6 years.
I guess we were hoping we would see it a little faster.
Madam Chair,
not only for our budget, but for the outcomes of the patients as well.
Madam Chair, I would agree, and hope that maybe it will happen faster. But right at this point, our numbers suggest that it's going to take a little bit longer.
You know, the project that has taken place in the private sector in some of the other parts of the country have shown that the project paid for itself quicker than 5 years, which is what we would have for the diabetes part of this after the next two bienniums.
And Madam Chair, again, the private sector, it's a little easier for them to direct their employees to these that are performing providers through tiering of benefits and other mechanisms. And I think that we need to maybe come up with ways in which we promote these providers to our clients in a different way. I'm not sure. We certainly don't suggest that we should do tiering of benefits for our clients, so it's not apply well for us. But that's one tool that they had that we do not.
All right, let's move on. Any other questions on this page? Okay.
The next budget proposal is on page 134. This proposal will provide physician-directed care coordination to manage complex health services for clients with chronic illness. Clients who receive our fee-for-service care are predominantly those with disabilities who have complex health care needs and use a higher level and more expensive level of health care services. Those clients would be very well served working with a physician-directed care coordinator to develop a care plan to help them navigate through the healthcare system while avoiding, when possible, costly emergency room and inpatient treatment. DHS on this proposal would provide physician-directed care coordination, which is really a key component of the medical home idea. And you're going to hear more about that. And the Healthy Minnesota project that was sponsored by MMA really talks about the medical home notion. This is a key component of that, whereby our clients would have a medical home, and then we would provide reimbursement to primary care physicians or their primary care physician. It could be a specialist in some cases. And to then provide for coordination for their complex healthcare needs.
And of course, these were directions that were given to you by the legislature probably 4 years ago to develop care coordination and case management for complex patients.
Madam Chair, you're right. This is a second step because what we did a couple of years ago, it was developed what's called intensive care coordination for the most expensive or most complex cases, whereby we're going to have a care management coordinator for those people. This is for the next tier of people. It is said in the literature that 1% of a population represents almost 50% of the cost. And you hear that rule about 20-80 all the time, where 20% of the population represents 80% of the cost. What this does is provide this second step to our intensive care coordination model, whereby we're providing care coordination for our clients through physicians. And this will then, I believe, treat about 2,000 or 3,000 people. And so we're talking about more being involved. And we don't believe a disease management approach per se is going to be that effective for our clients because our clients in fee-for-service have multiple conditions. Some cases, though, through the care coordination, they may be directed to a diabetic disease management program. But disease management per se really is not sufficient for our clients. They need much more chronic care management, if you will, that's much more complex and involved. Under this proposal, we would reimburse these care providers around $50 per month. We're still refining this a little bit. And now that our proposal is public, we are certainly seeking feedback from others as to how best to go about this. And this is just, again, for our fee-for-service clients, but it could be a model for our managed care partners. They could look at this and say, once they get more involved in serving people with disabilities, that perhaps this is something that they could adopt as well. And the type of things that would be provided under this care coordination model includes care coordination among primary care doctors and specialists, integration of medical services with community support resources, including social services that counties provide. We realize that our clients have more than just medical needs. They have social service needs and mental health needs and sometimes long-term care needs. And it's real important that the medical community coordinates with those services. It also involves patients and families in planning their own care. As I said, it complements our intensive care coordination model and other pharmacy and medical management initiatives that we have already. We are developing the ability to do more medical management and pharmacy management for our fee-for-service population, much more than, and again, under the direction of the legislature, much more than there has been in the past. In fact, one thing that we received just 2 weeks ago was a $2.8 million grant from CMS called the Medicaid Transformation Grant. That money is going to be used towards facilitating this kind of work the payment for performance work and also this care coordination work and our medication therapy management work that we do with pharmacists. We pay pharmacists to help have them help our clients manage their drugs. It's the one the first program in the country that has been adopted for Medicaid. So what we this Medicaid Transformation Grant is going to do is allow us to develop a communication tool with our providers to better for them better serve our clients and to communicate back with us as to what's going on. Now, eventually, we need to have them communicate with others in terms of electronic health records and things of that sort. Now, the budget for this is $174,000, but we have offsetting savings here beginning in the second year. And there's net savings in the second biennium under this proposal. And so we will see a return in this investment a little sooner than the payment for performance arrangement. This is all funded through the general fund.
Senator Prettner-Solman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rosberg, tell me a little bit more about how we pay the pharmacists to help our clients manage their drugs. Do we pay them other than the dispensing fee?
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solman, yes, we do. We pay them a certain amount, and I don't know if pharmacy manager is not.
But you need to remember, Senator, that anyone that's a dual eligible is in Part D now, and so they're not being managed by the state.
Well, and Madam Chair, I understood that the fees that we pay the pharmacists barely cover the costs of the dispensing, so I was wondering what additional fees they might get for.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solman, no, that goes beyond the dispensing fee. This is a set amount per month we pay them to do that management. We do that only in situations where the client is Medicaid only. We're not going to do it where Medicare is covering that because we're not involved in that transaction.
We're not going to do it where Medicare is involved.
Right. That was an unfortunate development. So we provide additional payment beyond the dispensing fee.
Do you remember the bill that Senator Lori carried for the medication management project? It started out with the Native American community clinics.
I'm afraid I don't, Madam
Well,
Chair.
Anyway, that did pass, and so there is a group of people that have additional medication management payments going to the pharmacists. It's not across the board. But, you know, mostly what we have left that's not in Medicare Part D are families and children who are not disabled. So, you know, they don't have as many of the chronic health care conditions.
Yeah, Madam Chair, you're right. About 50% of our clients with disabilities are dually eligible. So, you know, there's still other 50% that can benefit from this. Senator Prettner-Solman, we will get that information to you as to exactly how we pay and how many pharmacists are enrolled and how many clients are being seen. We'll get that information to you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Are there any other questions on this page?
The next page is page 136. This relates to the critical access dental payment program. This proposal would extend the current critical access dental payment program and make the add-on rates consistent with all of our Minnesota healthcare programs, meaning between Minnesota Care and medical assistance. For various reasons, including reimbursement rates, it is difficult for clients on our programs to access oral health care. In 2005, less than 45% of our clients had a dental visit. We've been working on this for some time, and we have other proposals that we have pursued, not just legislative proposals, but we've been working with the community on trying to increase access for oral health care. It's a big issue, not only for our clients, but in some cases for other people too. So mental health and oral health services are the two biggest challenges that we have for our clients in terms of access to services. We have at least leveled off the issue. We no longer have a decline. And you'll be receiving a report this next month, this month, I guess, by February 15th, as to what has happened in terms of our efforts to improve access to oral health care. At least we've leveled it off in terms of access, and it's not declining in the last couple of years. Back in 2001, the legislature did develop the special add-on rate for critical access payments, and the payment beyond the payment that they receive otherwise through the fee schedule. These providers have demonstrated a willingness to serve our clients and to establish capacity in underserved areas. The current rate is up to 50% above the medical assistance rate. However, that's been limited by an appropriation, so the results is that it's 6 or 7% above the rate. However, the legislature this past year funded the critical access program through June of this year for medical assistance, and then added for Minnesota Care an additional rate, 50% higher than the fee-for-service rate. So what's in statute right now is in medical assistance, there is a rate add-on rate of 38% above the fee-for-service rate, but that ends at the end of June. Then there's a 50% add-on in the Minnesota Care side, and that's ongoing as long as the money is available for that. So what we're proposing here is that we continue the medical assistance critical access add-on payment beyond June of this year, but we established it at 33%, and that would bring the Minnesota Care rate down to 33%, so it's equal. This budget page does not include the savings on the Minnesota Care side, and I'll just hand it that it's $100,000 for fiscal year, $131,000 for fiscal year 08. So the budget page does not reflect the reduction from 50% to 33% on the Minnesota Care side. The next iteration of this page will do that. So that's what we want to do is continue this effort and have, again, a add-on rate of 33% above the fee-for-service rate. We think that would be sufficient to have our dental providers continue to serve our clients.
So, Assistant Commissioner Osberg, under this proposal, will there be reductions over what's currently being paid to dentists who are in the critical access dental program?
Madam Chair, there will be reductions from what's being paid this 6 months, from January to June of this year. But it would be an increase.
What we did last year basically was to continue the payments at the level they were at.
But, Madam Chair, it was sunsetted, as I said.
It was sunsetted because it wasn't being paid for out of the general fund as it needed to be, because the administration had not provided anything for it in their budget. And, in fact, we're proposing to cut by 50% the payments going to dentists under the critical access dental program. So my question to you now is, will this be a reduction over what they've been paid?
Madam Chair, percentage-wise, yes, but overall it would be an increase because now we're – in the past, it was set at 40% above the rate. So it's a reduction from that 40% down to 33%. Yes, that is true. So there is a percentage reduction – That is the case. Between Minnesota Care and medical assistance now, it's going to be a better payment arrangement than we've had in the past for these dentists. This is, as you mentioned, Madam Chair, this is financed out of the Healthcare Access Fund, and that's how it was financed this past year, and we're suggesting that this continue to be financed out of the Healthcare Access Fund.
What is the general fund request on this page for, then?
Madam Chair, I think that's just a believe an offset.
It recognizes the transfer. The
change.
Transfer, so yeah, it's coming from. Yeah.
Okay, I think we understand it. It's just showing the money going into the general fund to pay for all the dentists. We're not going to keep doing that, Commissioner. We did it because it was kind of an emergency situation last time, but we're not going to keep paying for the critical access dental program in the medical assistance program out of the healthcare access fund. It's not appropriate. It wasn't appropriate to do it on that one-time basis either, but the fact of the matter was if we hadn't done it, we would have had a lot of dentists bail out of the program over that year, and we did it with instructions to the department that we expected them to fund it out of the general fund in their next budget request. Are there any other questions on this page, Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner, I would just like to comment that in my district, I live in Senate District 4 in the northern part of that district in Bemidji. The people in my area are traveling over 2 hours to see a dentist, and we have a whole generation of people who are in the lower end of the economic scale up in that area who do not have access to dental care, which, as I'm sure you know, has serious health ramifications for them indefinitely. I've talked to a number of dentists back in my area, and they're telling me at least that the reimbursement level as it stands today, even if they were to accept the add-on, that I understand if they take a certain number of patients that they'd be entitled to, would not even be enough to pay for the cost of hiring the assistant that they would need to provide the service. I also know from personal experience just over this weekend with a former constituent who's living down here now in the Seward area, that she just received a list of dentists that she's qualified for medical assistance that were supposed to be accepting medical assistance when she was just discharged from the hospital recently. And she called every name on that list, and no one was accepting medical assistance any longer other than some students that she finally was able to locate. So I guess just want to emphasize my concern over this issue. And then one question I have. In my district, a lot of people, even though it's not a very good rate of reimbursement, they are entitled to be paid mileage. And I would assume these are probably two different funding streams, but it just seems to make no sense to me that someone can be paid mileage to drive 2 hours to the dentist, but that money can't be made available somehow to pay to see a local dentist. Is there any way to put that money together?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, well, that's one of the reasons we do obviously pay for mileage for seeing a dentist is because in some cases they may have to travel a period of time. That is treated separately in terms of the transportation piece from the dental piece. But no, you're right. One of the key issues has been reimbursement levels, but there are other issues too. There's workforce issues. You know, we need to make sure we promote other dental auxiliaries and assistants and the provision of those providers. And in fact, we're developing a project called Oral Health Solutions Project, and we're waiting federal approval for it, whereby we're going to test a model where we encourage the development of oral health care systems where dental assistants and hygienists and dentists and school clinics and health Head Start clinics and things of that sort work together to really put together their resources to try to improve the ability, especially to access preventive dental care. But that has been there's no doubt about it, that the lack of reimbursement has been one of the major concerns for our dentists.
Senator Olson, just so you know how we arrived at this critical access dental program, we did at one point try and increase reimbursement across the board for all dentists, and we saw that they were gratefully accepting it for the ones they already had, but they still weren't accepting new patients. And so then we went to this strategy to try to encourage a larger payment for dentists that had a certain percentage of their caseload being public clients. And it's worked pretty well. I mean, I realize it hasn't entirely solved the problem, but we've over doubled the number of public clients being seen in dental offices in the state of Minnesota with the program. And it's just a little disheartening to me to see that the department isn't taking it seriously enough to think that it deserves general fund money. Are there other questions? If not, let's go on then.
And my last budget page is page 151. This proposal would provide an appropriation to assist medical assistants, Minnesota Care, Minnesota Family Planning Program applicants, to pay for required citizenship and identification documentation. would also provide funding for electronic data match system to verify birth records for applicants and enrollees born in Minnesota. On July 1st of last year, the federal law, which the state conformed to, required that medical assistants and Minnesota Care families with children and applicants and clients declared to be U.S. citizens or nationals must provide documentation of their citizenship and identity. Previously, MA applicants verified citizenship by attesting to their citizenship and signing the health care application under penalty of perjury. Federal regulations are very restrictive in this area and require specific kinds of documentation to prove that citizenship. Copies of acceptable documentation must be available in all case records. Failure to obtain documentation could result in the loss of federal funding. Again, federal funding members 50% for our program. A copy of a birth certificate or birth record data match satisfies the citizenship documentation requirement. The cost of a birth certificate, in some cases, Minnesota is $9, in other states it's more than that. And so what we want to do is provide for assistance to pay for that birth certificate. Federal regulations require that counties and Minnesota Care Operations assist applicants and enrollees who need help with obtaining documentation. And I think this has been going relatively well. It has been an additional burden, certainly for the client, but and also for the counties and state, but I think we've been able to make sure that the people get their documentation. There's not a lot of cases out there that we have found that, fortunately, that people's eligibility is in doubt because of this. So the counties have really have stepped up and done their duty in terms of helping people get this information. It's been a big burden. But it has increased their costs and it has increased the processing time for applications when you do this. And we, I think, at one point estimated it'd take an additional 20 minutes, but it's probably more than that. We also have established a special unit to assist counties and the Minnesota Care Operations with difficult cases so that we can have somebody help an applicant or a client track down their documentation. Currently, agencies submit a form requesting verification of birth to the Department of Health, and response time varies depending on the backlog. DHS is in the process of developing a data match system with the Minnesota Department of Health that would verify birth records for applicants and enrollees born in Minnesota. This would make it much more efficient for counties and for our Minnesota Care Operations by tapping into this data match system. So that's what we're asking funding for, is to help people pay for necessary documentation, but also to develop this data match system so we can make it more efficient for people to comply with this law. The budget asks for $736,000 for the next biennium, and most of this would be out of the general fund, a little bit out of the healthcare access fund, again, because it applies. In Minnesota Care, we also have federal money. We have Medicaid money and this SCHIP, this State Children's Health Insurance Program money. So this law applies where we have federal money. It does not apply to where we have state-funded programs, only like General Assistance Medical Care or Power of Minnesota Care for Adults Without Children is state-funded only.
Unfortunately, we didn't make it apply, so we don't have a larger budget page. Are there questions on this page? If not, then let's go on.
Madam Chair, I believe I am finished.
Oh, wonderful. Great. Well, it didn't take you an hour after.
No, I didn't.
Any other questions for Commissioner Osberg? If not, thank you very much. We appreciate your presentation.
Thank you.
Meeting's adjourned. Nobody tells me.
it makes. She just wanted. We should think about. I mean, does it make sense?
Wait, sure.
Just the savings and how he came up with
that. Would be great. And then, Marie, sorry, I have one other question, which is, this federal grant compliance, this is the, which one is it? Oh, the acute care physician directed care coordinator. And the CMS grant that we have for that, who can I talk to about it? Brian said that there's some kind of
What she might want,
I guess,
money
federal
might want
money that's available.
Yeah, because I mean, she wants them to actually provide like housing services. What sounded like?
I don't think so.
No, I have. It's in 140. I think it's in 140.
Are you on? Oh, yes. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I didn't.
No, no, no. Oh, okay, okay. Providing information on state-funded programs. She said, divide it to the ones. Oh, for the queries? No, they pay it. They pay it. They
pay. You know what you do.
I mean, there's family
and
planning.
The thing is, it's like
places. All right, they're probably providing. I think there was just like one positive alternatives. You know, I mean, referral.
At first, she was like, "Let's make all women."
Big important things to do.
Well, let me think about that. I mean, if somebody
could do it.
The women's right to know has a lot of it. She has. Let's get that information. Just wants a whole, just saying. Who is so the Commissioner of Human Services will get this information? Do, I mean, like, to provide this information.
Just was saying
that these places have to give the information.
And like the commission provided to them.
Email? That's the question, is what is a criteria? I mean, if you go and have an abortion, you know, women's right to know, you've got it, you know, they're going to give you that information. But so if you go to some place,
the purpose of getting... planning places.
Well, no. I mean, that's somebody place that's going to provide an abortion. Family plan.
Committee, and then we all these...
I mean, you know, if you've got a family planning grants, I mean, there are clinics that do it. It's, you know, not all family planning clinics, but actually most of them probably aren't providing abortions.
So those clinics already have to provide them.
We're still medicized today. We haven't worked anything out yet either.
That you're eligible for medical, you know, family